Hey guys, this is Adrian Vandenberg, all the way from Holland. You are listening to Talking Rock with Dave and Shane. Turn it up.
Hey everybody, this is Joe Lynchard.
Hi everybody, this is Rob Halford.
I'm Rudy Sargent.
Hey there, this is Steve Hackett.
Hey folks, this is Rick Emmett of Triumph, and we're Talking Rock with Dave and Shane.
Hi there, sir.
Hey, how are you?
Good. How are you?
Really good, thanks. I escaped to France last night, so life is good.
Very nice. Very nice. How's France this time of year?
Well, actually, normally it's a little sunnier, but it will change tomorrow, the day after tomorrow. So it's all good because I was just happy to be away for a couple of days, you know.
Absolutely. Well, we're certainly happy to have you. Adrian Vandenberg, a legend of rock and roll. So great to have you on the Rock of Nations show. We're really excited for the album Sin. The title track is out, the latest Vandenberg effort. You bring the thunder, you're bringing the crunch in this album, and a little bit of a different lineup. Talk about the lineup on this record here.
Yes, it's, since the last album, the 2020 album, well, the title says it all. It's 4 years ago. I had to change the vocalist, unfortunately, because I always liked to keep a lineup, stable, to keep like a band vibe going. But after COVID, our agendas didn't match anymore with the former singer, Ronnie Romero, and the plans we had touring-wise. So I was really, really fortunate to bump into Mats Levin, all the way from Stockholm, Sweden.
Yeah.
It worked out perfectly. I'm really excited about it because it also turned into a situation where I worked on the songs together with a vocalist for the only and first time since working with David Coverdale in Whitesnake. So it was quite an adventure for me as well.
Yeah. There's... Your playing is so synonymous with Whitesnake, of course, and so many other groups. And so we hear those sort of natural, you know, influences. I mean, it's your playing after all on there, but it's also, you know, Vandenberg's always had its own identity and it's evolved over time. How do you musically keep it? You find a balance of keeping it fresh, but also keeping it traditional too. How do you strike that balance? Like, we know it's you, but we also hear something different. Like, wow, that's different. That's pretty cool too, you know?
Yeah, interesting that you mentioned that because I didn't really think about it that much, which is probably the reason, actually, that may be the answer. What I do know is when I had a hiatus since Whitesnake stopped in 1999, David picked it up a couple of years later, but I couldn't be involved because he had all kinds of commitments with exhibitions of my painting and stuff. But my then girlfriend at the time and me got a baby daughter when my daughter was four, the relationship fell apart. So I decided not to be involved in touring and stuff until I could explain to her what I did. And I wanted to be as much as I could a part of her education. So when I started up, when she was about 12, so about 8 years ago or something, I didn't really have any preconceptions of what I was going to do because I kind of assumed that everybody would have forgotten about me. So I was all free to do whatever I liked and whatever I wanted. I wasn't stuck in a formula that you are when you are in a band that tours and makes records and scores hits and all the stuff. So ever since then, I'm just writing more intuitively than I've ever done before because I just let it flow. I put out my mental antenna, so to speak, and whatever comes in and I think, oh, that's pretty cool, then I work on that. And what I was conscious of when I talked to producer Bob Marlette for the first time, he produced the 2020 album and this one. When we started talking, the first thing he asked me was, how do you think it should sound? And to me, my answer was right away, I would love it is to sound like you walk into a band rehearsal, you stand right in front of the stage and the band is on fire and it's right in your face. It doesn't sound like a, what was the case a lot in the 80s where the band is all the way in the back of an arena. Yeah, I want it to be fresh and crisp and in your face. So, and not too much stuff going on, just a guitar, bass, drum, guitar, bass and drums and a vocalist. And a little touch of keyboards maybe here and there and way in the background. But what I've always liked about bands like Van Halen and AC/DC that you get those big rhythm guitars that go bam, you know, that's really important. It's just as important as guitar solos and maybe even more important to me because it's the backbone of the song, you know?
Yeah. You mentioned Bob Marlette, I mean, he's produced Tony Iommi. He's produced, so many other folks here. Looks like Rob Zombie, Alice Cooper, Lynyrd Skynyrd, Saliva, Shinedown, Marilyn Manson. So he's no stranger to the heavy, heavy stuff. And
yeah, right. And,
right. So did you guys just click? I mean, I know you worked with them on 2020 before. So like from the first time you guys worked together, did it, you guys just locked in, it sounds like.
Yeah, it was actually amazing, and we became instant friends. We get on great together, and we have a lot of laughs. And we both actually mentioned right away after the first couple of days in LA in 2020 that in the stage that of life where we are, both on the you know as a human, but also musically. You want to enjoy what you're doing. You want to have a lot of fun when you do it and a lot of laughs. And we had that right away. And it makes makes it not feel like work. You know, you do a lot of work because you work your ass off, but you have fun and you click on a musical level and you bounce ideas back and forth. And so it really, really worked. And we both mentioned very regularly also on the phone, we call, you know, man, I'm already looking forward to record the next album, you know?
Yeah, totally. Talk about the gear you used on this record. Cause I mean, you're known for like, I think the Mighty Les Pauls, but so many other, you know, you kind of have you've mixed it up, I think a little bit over the years, but talk about some of the gear going into this record too.
On this one, I did exactly the same as on the last one. And actually the Gibson Les Paul that I still play, I play with an old Vandenberg albums and also the Vandenberg's Moon Kings albums. Nice. It's like my go-to guitar together with one of my PV Vandenberg guitars, which is actually going to be re-released this year by PV.
Oh, wow. Okay.
That's really exciting. I usually use a combination of the two, and very rarely or occasionally, if I need like a nice, crispy, clean sound, I tend to use a Stratocaster. Amplifier wise, I used the same combination as on the 2020 album, which is a combination of a Bogner, a Marshall, and a Mesa Boogie. And that's it. I like to go straight into the amplifier and add possible effects later in the mix, you know, like chorus or a little bit of reverb or whatever, that kind of stuff.
What is I just got in Les Pauls myself. I picked up a 50s the Tobacco Burst. Well, actually a 50s Tobacco Burst standard, and one of the VOS customs. It was the 57 reissue, I think. It's heavy, but I love the feel, and it's great. I was attracted to it, of course, for the look at first, and then I'm like, okay, let me just play it first, and it just feels it's so versatile. You know, there's a versatility to it. I mean, I'm not doing anything, obviously, nearly what you guys are doing, but like just sitting in my bedroom playing, it's like, man, oh man. I mean, I can understand why legends like yourself, why this feels really good, you know, and it's been pretty consistent, you know, I think, fair to say.
Yeah. Yeah, it's right. You know, I still vividly remember when I was like an early teen, looking at pictures of Jimmy Page and Eric Clapton and Paul Kossoff and all those great players playing those amazing Sunburst Tiger Stripe Les Pauls, you know. I thought, oh man, I really hope there's ever a day where I can afford one of those suckers, you know.
And yeah.
when the first Les Paul I bought, you know, it was such a kick. Actually, before that, I had a fake Les Paul, like a Japanese bad copy with a bolt on neck. I mean, it was really bad, yeah. But but the fact that it looked like it, you know, it's such a Berlin design because it looks sexy and it looks classic at the same time, and it's just a great guitar, you know, and that's what I try to achieve with my PV Vandenberg guitar, you know, a guitar that that you can tell from miles away what guitar it is, like you can with a Stratocaster and Les Paul, you know, those are such timeless designs.
Yeah.
And Les Paul, man, yeah, there's a reason for it that everybody still plays it, you know?
Yeah, totally. You talked about your PVs coming back out. How exciting is that for you to have that re-released? Are there going to be any changes, any updates to it, or just that classic PV Vandenberg that everybody knows and loves?
Yeah, it is exactly the same. The craftsmanship is amazing. They're hand-built right now. And the only changes I wanted to make is instead of the Kaler bridge, I thought it would be smarter to have a Floyd Rose because those parts are available everywhere. And with the Kaler, I had a lot of people ask me, where do I get the parts, you know? And the other change is that there's going to be Seymour Duncan pickups on it, because
nice.
Every time when I used to buy a guitar or whatever, I always like to experiment with pickups, and I usually ended up using like one of the Seymour Duncan pickups because they've always been really great stuff. And this time there's going to be a couple of like the earlier ones, different versions. There's like a neck through that's all, you know, like massive. And there's the one that has that is mahogany with a tiger stripe maple top.
Nice.
And both have different pickups that I think fit very well, Duncan pickups, with the tone of the wood. So that's basically it. And the good thing of a Duncan pickup is if people still want to change it, you know, it's easy to sell them. And yeah. At the time, I developed those PV pickups with PV. But I heard often, I like to experiment with different pickups and stuff, but I took the PV pickup straight off the guitar when I bought it. That's what people told me. And then they are stuck with the pickup that maybe is going to be, difficult to get rid of or whatever. So for a lot of people, it was a bit of a waste of money, even though the pickups are great, because I play those pickups standard on all my PVs. Only one or two PVs I experimented with pickups, but the ones that are, for instance, on live on Donington Festival, that is the stock PV pickup.
Okay.
So yeah, it's a matter of taste.
Yeah, it's a beautiful sound too. It's just love that sound. You mentioned Whitesnake, and David Coverdale's talked about. I mean, he went through kind of a bit of a health thing recently, and had to delay a tour. He's basically talked about like he's going to get out there whenever he can, but you know, he's really looking to hang it up at this point. Like he's doing a final go round, basically, is what he told us a few months back.
The ailments and stuff really hurt you guys on this tour that you were going to be on last year. Yeah. It was heartbreaking for us. I mean, Reb and Tommy both, and you with your voice. Does it seem like this is, it's not going to happen, or are you determined to get out there one last time and do this right?
It's not really a professional decision. Right. It's literally a health decision. Mm. Last year, it took me 7 months to get rid of a really sinus infection that went so deep into my body, you know. And then we discovered a secondary one, which is why I had to cancel the US tour. So all of the appalling antibiotics I'd had for 3 months, at all the damage it did to my system, it was a waste of time because this other infection was canceling it out. So I had to go on to heavier medications and steroids and at the same time ignoring a torn rotator cuff. We have 3 to 5 years of projects here at my studio. So I've certainly not finished with music, but my health will dictate
right.
whether I can take on, because it's incredibly physically demanding for me.
What are your thoughts on just you know, the legacy of Whitesnake. You're a huge part of that, obviously. And David, you know, kind of, you know, sensing it's time to say farewell once he's able to health-wise to get out there and play some final shows.
Yeah, it's a, you know, I was already a Whitesnake fan for years when I finally joined. So it is a pity, you know, I mean, David has got such a unique voice, and his vocal approach is so unique that I find it a pity, you know, that he can't really carry on. I'm sure he finds it a bigger pity than all of us do, because when you're a born musician like David is, you know, it's gonna be hard, you know, to get to a point where you go, well, I can't do this anymore. You know, it's like for everybody, whether you're a sportsman or a musician or an artist or whatever, you know, if the thing that you've always done in your life out of your passion, out of your heart, when you get to the point where you can't do it anymore, that's gonna be really rough, you know. So, yeah, I really hope you will find a way to at least do like a proper goodbye tour or something, you know, because as we know, the last tour, you know, had to be cut short because of a health problem or whatever it was. I didn't really ask him. We are still in touch, you know, regularly.
When you joined, it was like, I know you were originally approached to join Whitesnake in the early 80s, but it was around the 87 album, right? How crazy of a time was that? I mean, did you guys meet on the video sets, I think, is that what I read? And then you guys just barnstormed the country, the world, really, on that huge tour. I mean, talk about how crazy that was.
Yeah, that was crazy. David approached me already in 1982, Vandenberg just had a hit single with Burning Heart, so I couldn't do it. You know, we stayed in touch once or twice. After that, he asked me if I was able to join then. I couldn't, but at the end of 86, I finally decided the time was right. So the album, the 87 album, was almost finished, apart from guitar parts and a solo that I played on Here I Go Again, which is one of my personal highlights, of course, because it changed my life.
Yeah.
And then, like you said, you know, the record took off ridiculously huge. I mean, who could have known, you know? It's and the tour was crazy, you know. You end up selling out arenas and stadiums worldwide for a year and a half in a row every night, you know. And to me, it never got old, because every morning when I got up, I thought, holy shit, you know, I gotta pinch my own arm to realize I'm actually experiencing this, you know. Yeah, those are memories that nobody's ever going to take away from me, you know?
Yeah. Was it strange? I mean, because I know you were following John Sykes a bit, like, on that record. I mean, was it strange at first kind of grasping the material? Because you weren't, I mean, you had the, so I know you played on the solo, but like for some of the other stuff, or did it kind of, did you get into it right away?
You mean in playing the songs on the 87 album?
Yes. Yeah, and playing the 87. Yeah.
Yeah, we were with Rudy Sarzo, Tommy Aldridge, and Vivian Campbell. We started rehearsing, and we rehearsed for about a week, because initially we started out supporting Motley Crue, so we only had to play 50 minutes. And we decided to go out fire and on all six and really kick some ass in 50 minutes, and it worked. But the thing was that the record took off so quickly. Here Go Again became number one in a matter of weeks. So we had to rehearse during sound checks to add some songs to the set, because we started headlining really soon after that, and we didn't even were prepared for that, you know. So
yeah,
we jammed a lot, and we slowly but surely added a couple of songs, so we would have a full-blown set to a headline set.
Wow, it's just amazing. And then you had the Donington show, and it's just like, what a whirlwind. I mean, do you miss so much Whitesnake, but like that era of music, the radio airplay? I mean, nowadays everything's on Spotify, and like, it's so hard. Like, we do our best to get the word out about an album and a gig, and, you know, but obviously back in those days, I mean, radio was much, much more supportive. I mean, there was a music industry. Do you kind of miss that part of the whole business, that there was a more coordinated industry back then than say now?
Yeah, you do, because on one hand, I've always been really realistic about that, because pop music is basically originally disposable music, you know, the name says it already.
Yeah.
So ever since the 40s and the 50s, when it started out slowly but surely becoming pop music, you know, with Elvis and then the Beatles and I mean, Frank Sinatra at some point was regarded as a pop singer, basically, because he had hit singles, you know, and stuff. Over the years, of course, as we know, it changed in to the extent of every kind of trend or whatever you want to call it has got like a certain lifespan. And in the 80s, when rock was ruling radio and MTV and everything, I was always aware of, man, this is not going to go on forever, you know, because tastes changes, and also the industry that music has become, and originally wasn't, of course, the industry wants to have new stuff coming in and kick out the old stuff, because otherwise they're not going to sell product as they want to do, you know. So I'm already extremely happy and grateful that I was part of that huge rock movement in the 80s. In the 90s, it became a little depressing. There were a couple of really good bands and like amazing singers like Chris Cornell, but to my ears, most of it was crap, because there weren't great guitar players, there weren't great drummers. The singers all sounded like, you know. And I grew up with singers like Robert Plant, Coverdale, and Ron James Dio and Paul Rodgers. So when you hear those grunge singers go, rawr, 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 then I go, and what the hell is this all about?
Yeah.
So rock became a little depressing. And in the 2000s, you know, it became like more very poppy, you know, like Coldplay and all that stuff that I don't really care about, because to me, it's very personal. Obviously, I want to hear a great guitar player in a band, you know, and I want to hear a great singer and a great drummer, and then it does something for me. So I'm actually very, very happy that the last 2 years, it really seems to be coming back, even though the mainstream radio and TV don't see it as such. But there's a lot of 80s, 90s bands still touring again, and the crowd is there, you know. The crowd just hasn't been serviced in the last decades, but it's coming out, you know. People are loyal and they want to hear that music, and we want to play that music, so it's interesting.
Yeah, it's really cool too to see all that. Who do you is there anybody who grabs you now, like on social media? Well, I say social media because I feel like that's how, like Steve Lukather was saying, if you don't, you know, you can write a song, you could write like the next Stairway or something like that, but if you don't have a lot of followers, like a million followers, something like that, no one's going to take it. It was an interesting quote, but I feel like you have to be on social media these days, these younger people, to even be noticed. Like, you know, sometimes on Facebook, there's like a really amazing guitar player that pops up, you know, and you're like, oh, that's cool. But is there anybody that grabs you these days as a guitar player, like any of these younger players?
Yeah, there's this, I'm not big on fusion type of playing and stuff, you know. I'm quite, for me, there has to be a blues element in it, to my personal taste, whether it's Blackmore or Jimmy Page or Paul Kossoff or Leslie West, yes, Eddie Van Halen, Michael Schenker, you know, all those great guys, Randy Rhoads. But there's this young guy called Matteo Mancuso, who's technically amazing. And I played some of his stuff the other day, you know. He seems to be in touch with my friend Steve Vai quite a lot.
Yeah.
I think Steve kind of discovered him or something. I don't know exactly. I'm going to ask Steve, because we became really good friends when we started touring, and we're still in touch. But yeah, that's one guy where I go, holy shit, you know. And a lot of other guys, to me, but that's very personal, you know, are technically amazing, but I can't really tell the difference between a lot of them, you know.
Sure.
It became so technical, and that's quite understandable, because kids these days, you know, they go to YouTube and they basically get private lessons from guys like Steve Vai and Joe Satriani and stuff.
Yeah.
So they all seem to focus on the technique and forget to develop your own voice as a guitar player. Where, like when you hear Brian May or Jeff Beck or whoever, after a couple of notes, you can tell that's this guy. You know, the same goes for people like Michael Schenker and even Halen. You know, right away, it's them. So that's what I miss a little bit. But it could be personal. I don't know. You know, I'm so fortunate that I grew up with Hendrix and Clapton in his Cream days, and Paul Kossoff and Leslie West and all those guys who had their own voice. You know, so. That and I was too lazy to figure out the solos, and well, not lazy, I didn't have the patience. So I played guitar all day, but after trying to figure out what somebody was doing, I got impatient after 2 minutes, and I thought, I'll figure out something myself.
Yeah, I gotta improvise a little bit. Yeah. You mentioned that Steve Vai, very cool guy. We talked to him maybe about a year ago. He had, when he did the Hydra guitar, that monster guitar that he put out. Yeah. You guys have any recordings that we haven't heard at all? You and Steve Vai just jamming, anything that we might be able to hear at some point?
No, only the live stuff with Whitesnake, you know, that's of course ages ago. But it's interesting that you mention it because for years and years and years, I've always thought at some point, I may want to record an instrumental album because I've got so many ideas for instrumentals laying around, and I would definitely invite a couple of guests, and Steve would definitely be one of them. It could be kind of cool, but
yeah, that'd be awesome.
Yeah, right now I'm probably too focused on on doing my band stuff, so we'll see.
Sure. Yeah,
in the words of James Bond, never say never.
That's right. Definitely. You mentioned some of your favorite singers. Obviously, Coverdale was in there. You mentioned Ronnie James Dio also. What did you think of Ronnie James Dio? I mean, we're doing a kind of a tribute piece on him. How did that voice and persona capture you?
Well, I mean, everybody who's familiar with him will agree that he was one of the most amazing singers. And not a lot of people don't realize, I think, it seems to me, because he's got all these rock fans, but even my mom, who didn't love rock at all, when Ron James Dio in Holland and other European countries, he was involved in a massive hit single by Roger Glover, the Purple bass player, a song called "Love Is All." I don't think it was a hit in the States, but his vocals on that was amazing. And my mom said, "Who is that singer?" I said, "Mom, it's a rock singer." And now you're kidding. You know, he was such an amazing singer that it transcended just the rock singer, the singing, you know. It was stunning. And he was such a nice, tiny guy with this huge voice and this amazing range and expression in his voice, you know. I mean, yeah. I still play it, and I think millions of people do, because it's so timeless, and you get grabbed by the throat with every performance that he recorded.
Yeah, yeah, just so iconic. And I mean, the Rainbow stuff, oh my god, you know, that documentary, I think it's coming out actually on DVD, I want to say. That was recently done by Wendy Dio. So good. Saw a preview of it. Just so incredible. You know.
Yeah.
Any Moon Kings updates that we might see? Do you think? I know that's kind of a previous project in the past, but we're always curious about anything and everything Adrian Vandenberg.
Yeah. Thanks. Yeah. You know, Moon Kings. I look at it as I put it in the fridge, because. My good friend Jan, the singer, he has this huge farming company, so he couldn't be out of the country for more than a day, which made me set up this Vandenberg thing, because I really started missing international touring. But at some point, I would love to do another Moon Kings album and with those guys and do some shows, you know, and maybe by the time Jan will have sold his company and and he can actually be away for more than a day, you know. So
yeah,
I really enjoyed that phase, and I think we did some great records, and the live shows were so much fun that I'm thinking about, you know, maybe do a small tour next year or the year after that or something.
Any favorites, or are they all your babies?
Favorites, yeah. It changes from day to day, but the song Sin is always in there. House on Fire is in there. And we're about to release another single next week, a song called Light It Up. And that's like one of your typical stadium rockers that Sin was more is more like a whole story. It's basically like a whole movie, and this is what one of those you know, right in your face stadium rockers. I'm really looking forward to the release next week, and then and like you said, the album release is going to be about a month from now, and I'm really excited about it, you know, because I worked my ass off on this album, so
yeah. It's so good. And it's like you've got that trademark, you know, Vandenberg sound that goes back to Burning Heart. And then you've got like some, you know, it's updated. It's a modern feel, and it's just that balance. You perfected it. You really did. It's awesome. It's great.
Thanks very much, man. Thanks.
Yeah, we're really fired up. We are really fired up for it. Anything else you'd like to add at all, sir?
Only that I'm really, really looking forward. I mean, it sounds like the biggest cliche, but I'm really looking forward to finally tour the States again, which is going to be early next year, because the last tour in the States was in the early 90s.
Wow.
And that's scary, you know, this is like almost 30 years ago.
Jeez, yeah. And
I barely realized that I'm already 30 years old, you know, so let alone. And, you know, I really enjoyed being in the States again with the Monsters of Rock cruise that we did twice now. I really got a taste of it being back in the States, you know, and hanging with the rock fans in the States. I'm really, really looking forward to that.
Yeah. Well, yeah, you'll find that. I mean, the rock fans in the States are just like, they're itching. I mean, there's still, I think, like you said, you know, just kind of underserved, you know, these days by like, you know, radio and some of the old tradition, the older traditional rock media, but it's there, you know, the fan base is there, and you know,
right,
we can't wait to have you. This, it's gonna be so cool.
Man, thanks so much.
Adrian Vandenberg, thank you so much for doing the show, man. It's a pleasure, man. So cool to talk with you. Sin is the album, August 25th, coming out next month. Check it out, ladies and gentlemen.
Hope to see you in the States.
Absolutely, yeah, we'd love to catch you on tour.
Great, man. Take care.